everybody, and welcome to another episode of True Stories from Tinseltown. And I have a goodie for you today. I have a wonderful guest. She is Barbara Sternick. She was a tabloid reporter for Rona Barrett, and she was also like Miss Thing for the National Enquirer, and she has the best stories and the best books. She wrote two books. I believe the first was Secrets of a Tabloid Reporter, my 20 years on the National Enquirer's Hollywood Beat, and then the second one was Celebrity Secrets of a National Enquirer Reporter, Further Adventures on the Hollywood Beat. Barbara Sternick, thank you so much for coming on. I am so appreciative of it.
It's my pleasure, Grace. Believe me, really. It's always fun.
Your books were fun. Fun reads.
Well, I had a lot of fun in all those years out here in Hollywood covering all the big celebrities. I got into a lot of unusual escapades.
Oh, my God. We will talk about some of them. And I just have to say, guts, chutzpah, nerve, you had it all. So why don't you tell us how this nice young lady became a tabloid reporter in Hollywood? Where are you from?
I was raised in the Chicago area, and actually I was the daughter of our grade school principal. I always minded my P's and Q's. My brother did, and our brief was to be good examples for the other kids, you know, so I was very well behaved. Then, on top of that, I attended an all-girls convent school for high school, you know, in which there's silence in the halls and walking in a single file and uniforms and the nuns. I was a superstar student and all of that. So I think when I broke out, when I got out of college, I went to work in rock and roll radio. That was my first few years out of college. And it was so much fun to not have to be so, you know.
Good.
Actually, when my tenure at the radio station was happening, my boyfriend was one of the disc jockeys. The reason that I moved to Hollywood was not because I wanted to cover entertainment or I wanted to be in the middle of movie stars or anything like that, but my boyfriend broke up with me, and I was so annihilated that I couldn't even stand to stay anywhere near where all of this unhappiness had happened, and so I just put my back of my hand to my forehead, and it was very drama, and I moved as far away as I could go without getting wet, and that was Los Angeles, you know, so I ended up with a job here writing news at an all-news radio station. Well, within a couple of months of that, one of the staff members the radio station, one of the executives, his wife happened to be Rona Barrett's editor on her magazine, and the girl had just been promoted to being the magazine editor. She had left her old job vacant, which was to write Rona's television report, her daily gossip report, which was syndicated on about 60 stations around America. So this guy said, oh my gosh, the way you write would fit in perfectly for Rona, because I always like to have fun with the stories and put a, you know, beginning, a middle, and an end in them and put a little kicker at the end.
Yeah.
So anyway, he set up an interview for me with Rona, and unbeknownst to me, actually, and so I went to this interview just for the heck of it, and sure enough, she hired me. So that started my immersion in Hollywood. And every single night, we were out to all the events and functions and parties and openings and all kinds of stuff with the Glee lights and, you know, intermingling with all of the stars, gathering gossip items. And that was how I kind of got my grounding, which led to my job at the National Enquirer.
How was it working for Rona?
Well, you know, Rona was wasn't the easiest boss. You know, she was I don't know how to describe it. It was very interesting. I would never say anything bad about Rona, because if it wasn't for Rona, I wouldn't have moved on to the next step, you know. She gave me a great break there. She was interesting to work for. She was very connected in Hollywood. She had all kinds of She came here when she was quite young and was part of young Hollywood in the days of Natalie Wood and Robert Wagner, you know, when they were all just starting out, and Tony Perkins and all of those people. So she had a lot of connections. And, you know, because of that, that's why she got her job doing this television report. She was very much a pioneer in gossip reporting. She was before ET. She was before all the daily TMZs and all this kind of stuff.
Or the blogs. They're all over the place. Gossip is all over the place.
No, there was nothing. You know,
yeah.
She was before the ravenous celebrity press.
Mm-hmm.
And I report, as I look back, and sometimes I have occasion to look back on one or two of the old scripts, and they were so mild compared to what's happening now. But, you know, she was controversial in her day and with certain people. And others loved her. And all the PRs loved her because they wanted their clients' names on television. And Rona had the first, you know, daily gossip report on television. It was dropped into the news in 10 o'clock newses all over the country. Especially, we were syndicated by Metro Media, which was a big network at that time. And so we were in all the flagship cities, New York and Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, and then many, many, many other stations in all the markets you could really mention, all the important markets. So that was a terrific immersion, and plus which I made a whole book full of contacts of my own. So that's why I was able to, you know, step right into my job at the Inquirer when that one came up.
Yes, but in between, after you left Rona, this just makes me laugh. You became, your friend was a magician on a cruise ship, right?
Yes, that's right.
And he needed a magician's assistant, and you were the spangled assistant.
I was freelancing in between Rona and the Inquirer. I was, you know, freelancing for a few months, His name was Lee Edwards, and he was a very talented magician. He worked not only cruise ships, but lots of other things. But he had a contract with Princess Cruises, and the girl that usually acted as his assistant had gotten engaged, and she didn't want to go away. It was going to be for like 9 months. And so he said to me, Barbara, why don't you do this? You know, you'll look great in the costumes. And I said, yeah, but I don't know how to do that stuff. I'm not a performer. I'm a writer. And he said, no, I'll train you. So that's what he did. Every night for about a month, he trained me how to do everything. And off we went. And, oh, my God, it was so much fun. It was just a dream job, because you had no responsibility, and your only job in life was to do 3 or 4 shows a week, and then just get tan and have fun and talk to the passengers.
Really? Only 3 and 4? It's changed a lot now on cruise ships. They work you to death.
To death, yes. No,
yeah.
We did probably 4 shows a week.
Not bad.
Great big ones, and then we did a couple of lounge shows in which we did more close-up magic, but the ships, don't forget, were much smaller in those days. that was a long time ago. The ships were only, this was the original Princess Cruises fleet, only 3 little ships, 20,000 tons.
Wow.
175,000 tons, you know. So this was a very intimate way of cruising around the world. And the Pete was a much different kind of passengers, too, because just ordinary people wouldn't have they wouldn't go cruising. They wouldn't have the money. They wouldn't have the time to do that.
No, and now it's pretty popular. And people always end up getting some sort of, like, diarrhea or something. I'm reading about it all the time. Some flu, some food poisoning. Something's happening.
Oh, I know.
It's awful.
It's much too big. They're big, and they have to cater to so many thousands of people. And, of course, yeah, that's another way that it's different. But, yeah, that was my—and they called me—I had a nickname on board the ships. I was the sorcerer's apprentice.
Oh, that's good. Did you have a magic wand?
Oh, no, I didn't have one. He did. And then I came home, and, of course, I was devastated to come home because I was so accustomed to having no responsibilities, and all of a sudden I was dumped back into real life, you know. And I figured, oh, my gosh, I better get my feet back on dry land here. I need a job. And the National Enquirer had been offering me this job for months before I left. And so I thought, oh, my gosh, I don't know if I really want to work for the Inquirer. It's got this reputation and everything. And but they were the only ones they were offering. So I went with my hat in my hand to the editor, and I said, "See, Alan, do you still have any positions open for a reporter?" He said, "You know what? We have one position open." He said, "I wanted you before. I still want you. If you want this job, you have to tell me now." So I said, "I'll take it."
And you were hesitant at first because of the big, people were upset with it. Celebrities were upset with it. I don't know. Was it meaner then? Because, like, with all the, all the stuff that's out now, and you
No, it was not meaner. I would not describe it as meaner. What it was just kind of a black and white rag is what it was. And they weren't sure that they wanted that type of publicity. They would rather be in the glossy magazines. But the Inquirer changed a lot over the years that I was there. It was kind of a black and white gossip thing, and we had some unusual genres that we featured within our pages, but not all unusual, but we did have some genres one story I remember I found it so shocking. It wouldn't be shocking today. It was a couple, a man and a wife, and they had both changed sexes, so the wife became the husband and the husband became the wife. I mean, this was something that was so shocking to people. And, Burt Reynolds didn't want to be on the page next to that.
Well, what year was that? Like, because this was pretty much unheard of then.
Yes, it was. It was in, let's say, the mid-late 70s.
So did these two people actually have the gender reassignment, or did they just, like, wear the clothes, change their hair, and do that kind of thing?
That's a detail that I really can't recall, but I think they had gender reassignment. And that story was actually, this was something that sort of used to make me mad, because people always said, "Oh, that nasty rag, the National Enquirer." And yet, there was an early television tabloid called That's Incredible. John Davidson, I think it was Kathy Lee Crosby was the girl, and Fran Tarkenton were the hosts. And they did all these wild stories, and they used to go into our pages every single week and yank our stories out of the National Enquirer and put them on That's Incredible. And then they had acceptance, and they would put on the air, they used to put down the tabloids, yet they were stealing our material every week.
And doing good in the ratings.
doing good, and everybody then believed the stories. As I say, the Enquirer really evolved during my tenure there. And we began during those 20 years that I was there, this was the golden age. This was the rise of tabloid power. This was the tabloidization of the American media. Everybody started to do the kinds of stories that the Enquirer did, and the entertainment culture began to prevail. Even on the lead story of the evening news, you'd find a story about a celebrity as the lead. This had been unheard of in the Walter Cronkite era,
Mm-hmm.
So, the Enquirer was a very influential part of that process. In fact, there's going to be a documentary about the Enquirer coming up this fall under the aegis of CNN. We don't have an air date yet, but myself and quite a few of the other, veteran reporters from the Enquirer will be speaking of our experiences on that.
Well, I will definitely watch that, and I will tell the podcast peeps who listen when to look for it, because who doesn't love this kind of juicy stuff? But why don't we start talking? This is your first, Angie Dickinson, she was your real first celebrity assignment, right?
Yes, that's right. Oh, my gosh. Yes, it was. And she had Angie Dickinson, for the younger listeners who don't even know who she was, she was a sort of a beauty. She was married to Burt Bacharach at one time. She dated Johnny Carson. She dated JFK, secretly. That didn't come out until years. But anyway, she had a show called Police Woman. So this was a very top-rated show. So my editor said to me, "Okay, Babs, I want you to get in your car and go out to Busch Gardens," they had an amusement park at this big, beautiful amusement park at the brewery, Busch Brewery. And And they're filming policewomen out there, and I want you to go out there and interview Angie Dickinson. So being fresh out of Rona Barrett's, stable, I figured it was all set up and everything was fine and I was expected. So I went out there and I got through the gate and I said, I'm here to interview Angie Dickinson. And the guard let me in and told me where I should go and park my car. Got out of the car. Here's her dressing trailer. So I went over to the trailer, knocked on the door. Angie Dickinson comes out. Opens the door, and I said, oh, hello, Miss Dickinson. I'm Barbara Sternick from the National Enquirer. I'm here to interview you. And she looked at me like I just stepped off the first rocket ship from the moon. Then her face fell, and she almost turned beet red. Smoke started coming out of her hair. And she hauled back, and she screamed, how dare you come here? And she hauled off and slugged me on my arm. And I'm telling you, I reeled backwards. I almost just started crying, not because it hurt, but because I just couldn't believe what was going on here. And she said, get out! Get out of here! So I kind of gathered myself together, and I kind of went sobbing, went over to my car, and I couldn't find my key, and I get in my car, and all the crew were looking at me, and or they had sympathy in their eyes, believe me. They weren't mad like she was. So I drove back to my office on Wilshire Boulevard, and I went into the editor's office, and I said, oh, my God. How could you do that to me? I wasn't. She slugged me.
And she seemed so nice, that Pepper.
And she, oh my God, she seemed beautiful, Angie, and beautiful. Always seemed so nice and amusing. And she just, so who did she choose to hit? Little me from the convent school.
I know. That's awful. And that's your first. Well, you have encountered celebs before, but that was your first inquirer. Encounter.
That was my first, let's get out of the office, not do a phone or just get out of the office, go out there, do this. Well, anyway, it turns out that the Enquirer, powers that be, thought I was some kind of a hero because I took a slug for a story, you know? And so I mean, the boss thought I was great. You know, our boss down in Florida, he thought I was pretty cool because I did that. It turned out to be an okay thing for my career at the Enquirer. Our editor in California, Alan Markfield, took me out for a nice dinner, and he plied me with, you know, lovely dinner, and he plied me with some champagne, and he said, you're going to be great. You can do it. You can handle it, kid.
Well, I guess you could. I mean, you cried, but you were shocked. You were stunned.
Yes, I was. I learned in time not to cry, just to take it as part of the deal. It wasn't me. It was the Enquirer that they didn't like.
And that's true. And you had to think of it that way. All of a sudden she heard it, and it's like she, you know, she went ballistic like Mrs. Hyde. And she, but it's very funny, and it's much more detailed in the book. I just laughed, and I felt bad for you, and then I felt bad for Angie because she the National Enquirer people, she wasn't expecting you, so she probably thought you were being a pushy broad or something. Or
well, you know what she thought? I didn't know this, and nobody told me this before I went out there. Some other reporters had been digging around and snooping around her home and everything. They were doing, and all her childhood friends, they were doing, that was a genre we used to do, childhoods of the stars. Mm-hmm. They were trying to dig up the dirt on Angie's childhood. Well, I knew nothing about that story, and I just thought I was going to do a nice interview about policewoman, you know? So anyway, but she thought I was there to do some snooping about her childhood, and so that's another reason she was so angry and upset.
Also her JFK thing, because I remember she got offered, you know, a few million to write her memoir, but she had to mention, you know, what really went on with Kennedy and others, and she declined to do it because she didn't want to talk about it.
Oh, it's so true. And, you know, the interesting follow-up to that was after he was killed, of course, which is so many, many, many years ago. But you know, so then Angie Dickinson was still rather prominent into the 70s. And after he was killed and she finally got more comfortable talking, and I don't know, I guess after Jackie remarried and everything, she started to put memorabilia out in her house, pictures of him and different things that he'd given her.
Wow.
Yeah, and then she was a little more open about it.
Was she with Burt Bacharach at the time?
It was after her divorce from Burt. Yeah, after she divorced Burt. But, yeah, so, well, time changes things, you know, changes perceptions. And
yes.
And that was certainly a rather amazing feature to have in your background, isn't it?
Yeah, but she kept that stiff upper lip and did not do it. Now, I love this story. I love, there are so many we're not going to be able to get to, but you guys, I totally, if you love tabloids, if you love scoops and gossips, you're going to love Barbara's book because it's funny. It's like a great beach read, rainy day read. It's too damn hot to go outside read. You know, I read both books in a weekend, a very hot weekend. Okay, so this one I want to talk about because I adore this man. You and Richard Burton.
Oh, yes, that was a fun story.
I want to ask you this first, though, Barbara, before we get into your Peeping Tom thing. I want to ask, so Susie Hunt was a model, and she was married to some race car driver, right?
Yes, James Hunt.
A big flirt who wanted to know you in a biblical way. And so they had a place in Switzerland along as the Burtons did for years, correct?
Yes, in Stade, that's right.
Right. So Susie, when he left, the Burtons would have her over and she'd hang out with them, both Elizabeth and Richard. And then when they moved back to California, Susie also went back with them. Mm-hmm. Right? Don't you think Elizabeth was a little, this was during their second marriage, which did not last long. Don't you think she was like, what's up with this? You know, or did she just think it was innocent?
You know, I wish I had known Elizabeth Taylor, but I didn't. So I can't speak to her mindset in that. As a woman, I think almost any woman would feel very uncomfortable having even though, obviously, Elizabeth Taylor was always touted as one of the most beautiful women in the world, but Susie Hunt was pretty darn attractive, too.
Very, and much younger, right?
Much younger, tall, willowy, blonde, different type. And you know, Burton had a discerning eye for the ladies. He liked beautiful women, and he and Elizabeth had a very tempestuous relationship. And I think the second marriage was probably even more tempestuous than the third than the first. I can't speak to how she might have felt.
Yeah. Let's just say, as women, you and I think I would have felt it pretty strong. I really do.
Yes.
I would have felt incredibly insecure. So anyway, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
you don't think what?
No, I wouldn't have let her come with, actually, me.
Me either. Maybe she didn't want him to. I would have hit him over the head with a bottle of champagne, for goodness sakes. Wait, these two, you know, the best bottle of champagne. Or maybe a cheapo one, just to get really mad. Anyway, so they go to California for, like, a break.
I live in California, but they came out.
Right.
And my assignment was find out what's going on. There was a rumor going around that Burton was with Susie Hunt and that they were going to get married. And after he and Elizabeth's marriage broke up finally and irrevocably. So I had a friend in real estate who was able to figure out that they had rented a house in Beverly Hills and told me exactly where it was and everything. So, of course, I tried the front door first.
You got some cuts. Yes.
Tried the front door. The maid comes and says, oh, Mr. Burton's not here. So
speak English, right?
So I couldn't take that to the bank. No way. I believed he was there. So because he wasn't filming that day, and I just thought they were there. So anyway, I thought I better scope this whole place out. Well, it turned out it was on a big curve. That house was the corner house, and then the curve went down a hill. So the house was kind of up from behind. It was up on a hill, and from the front, it was at the street. So I went down the hill to the back of the house, and there were no other houses. It was quite a steep hill. I parked my car down there, and I thought, you know, I wonder if that fence could possibly be the backyard of the Burton house. So, and here I'm wearing heels, you know, and the whole shebang. And so I go up this hill that's covered with these spongy plants, and I'm trying to juggle myself and my tape recorder. And I got up to the top, and there was like a little ledge there that you could walk along at the fence. And I found a knot hole, and I look into the knot hole, and there was the swimming pool of the house. And who do you think was lying by the swimming pool? Susie Hunt.
Eureka.
Yeah, Eureka. So I just stood there for at least an hour spying on them, and kept coming out. And I mean, I was just hoping she wouldn't take her top off or something, you know. I didn't want that much of a exposure, but anyway, I was able to, you know, and he came out, and he was so adorable with her. And he said, he kept on coming out to make sure she wasn't taking too much sun because she was so fair. And finally, after I'd been watching for about an hour, a butterfly came fluttering around the fence. And Susie decided she wanted to try to catch this butterfly. And she comes over and she had a butterfly net. He went in and got her one. She brings this net out. She's whomping on the fence, and I'm right behind the fence with my eye poking through there. And so Burton comes over, and he's just hugging her. And then he confirms that, you know, they say something about getting married. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, you just confirmed my whole story. I couldn't even believe it. So anyway, then he goes back, and finally he says, from the door of the house, the back door, she's by the pool, he says, your headmaster says it's time to come in. I'm going, oh, my God, be still, my heart.
Swoon, swoon.
Isn't that adorable?
Yes. How old was she? She was like 23 or something. Richard was 50.
Yeah, he was about 50. She was in her late 20s, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But anyway, so that was quite an amazing experience.
It's amazing they didn't see you because they were so close to where you were.
So close.
It's amazing you didn't. Well, you kind of tumbled down the hill a little bit.
I kept on sinking into the ground, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, I hope I don't lose my balance and go rolling down this hill.
Weren't you? You got the scoop du jour. You got what you needed.
Yes, and it was the kind of thing that the Enquirer was very famous for, too. You know, never taking no for an answer. And that was really the theme of so many of the stories that I tell in my book. The first book especially has The Secrets of a Tabloid Reporter. That one has Sinatra and Robert Culp and Pat Sajak wedding, and there's all kinds of crazy stuff in all of those chapters.
So good. So good. And so brave. I could never have done. I would have been fired my first day. I would have cried. I really do think I would have been, because I'm not good. Oh, I love this. You were so close that you could see Susie Hunt's red nail polish, toenail polish.
Yes. And I made sure to describe her bathing suit, so just in case you tried to deny it, she would know that's the bathing suit she was wearing.
And he was like a lovey-dovey guy.
So cute. So protective, yeah.
And gorgeous. You know, a lot of people don't get it, but with the voice, I liked his face. I thought he was just really hubba-hubba, you know?
He was really a very elegant, handsome, classy guy. Yeah, he was a neat guy. There were a few other. The other one that I always loved so much, I always loved Robert Mitchum.
Oh, swoon. So tell us your Robert Mitchum. He was like your, he came to your rescue. He was quite the gentleman.
Yes, he was. And people think of him as a film noir villain or, you know, a detective or something, somebody kind of dark. And but you know what? He was such a gent. And I'd always just thought he was the coolest guy. And I always loved that cleft in his chin, too.
Oh, and that slow-eyed look and sort of that smirk. Yes.
I know it.
Love him.
Yeah.
Made me love him more when I read your book.
Oh, yes, I'm sure, because now you saw something really deep about him. But in my encounter with Robert Mitchum was, actually I had a few encounters with him over the years, but this was really the best one. I was assigned to go out to the big chili cook-off that they hold every year. I think they still do out in Rosemead, California. It's maybe about a 50-mile ride outside of L.A. proper. And so I got in there, and it's all cowboy-themed, and I'm toodling around gathering stories and stuff like this. And in the evening, they had a big dinner. So I go into the dinner, and I sit down at they had big plank tables, long tables, mm-hmm. and I sit down. There's some empty chairs on my side, and some ladies are across the table from me. So I sat down, and the ladies began to talk among themselves, and then they asked me, well, what do you do for a living, dear? What are you doing here? So I told them I was a National Enquirer reporter. They immediately became very cold and snooty with me. It turns out they were, I won't even mention, you won't know the names, and I didn't know the names either. They were old-timey actresses, I guess, but they just took such a snooty attitude towards me. And then they started to sling some insults my way. Well, just about then, there was an empty chair next to me, and I hear the chair slide out, and somebody kind of slid into it, and I look to my right, and it's Robert Mitchum.
Pitter patter, pitter patter.
I know, and then all the ladies start saying, "Oh, hi, Bob! Oh, how are you, Bob?" And they started to be all nice to Bob, and then they started to actually speak about me in front of Mitchum and saying, "Well, I don't know why she has to be. I mean, I don't know what she's doing here from the National Enquirer." Well, anyway, so he listened to this stuff. And, you know, we had the dinner and everything, and after the dinner, they started to say some other things. And Mitchum turns to me and he says, you know, Barbara, would you like to go outside and get some fresh air? And I thought, oh, boy, I need some fresh air after this experience with these ladies being mean. So anyway, it turns out he was my hero. He took me and we sat on this kind of old-timey Western bench outside there for a while and just watched the people go by chatting. He had the nicest talk. And then we wandered around the pool area, and finally it started to get dark, and I, you know, I realized, oh, my God, I've got my tape recorder in my purse. And I asked him if he would mind just going on tape with some of these great stories he was telling me about when he was a younger guy. And he told me why he was so... Sorry, that's my phone. He told me why he was so offended when those ladies did that. Because he said, you know, I've been sort of an outsider in Hollywood myself. And so I understand what that's like when people say bad things to you or judge you when they don't even know you or what you're trying to do. So he and I had the nicest interview, which appeared in the Enquirer, and I actually had some notes in it, which I include in the second book. Has the story of Bob Mitchum and some of the stuff that he was telling me is reiterated in that chapter. But I always thought the world of him. He was, and I could never think anything else because he was such a gentleman.
I've read that, and he was so down to earth. And I read this story, or I don't know where I found it, but this is a funny one because I can see him doing it. He was in the only film noir Katharine Hepburn ever did, which, what in the world was it called? I can't remember, but Robert Taylor was in it as well. And, you know, I'm sorry, Katharine Hepburn is not a film noir kind of dame. And it was a silly story. I think it's Underside or something like that. Mm. And she just was like talking out loud. Oh, these young actors don't know how to act. They stink, whatever. And Robert Mitchum farted. Because that just sounds so him. Like, really, Kate? You know, and blew her a little Mitchum love. Her way.
That's fantastic.
Because she was she was not always a very nice woman. But he, you know, they say Charles Lawton, who worked with him on Night of the Hunter, said, you know, he is no rough and tumble guy. He loves poetry. He loves singing. He could have been Macbeth if he wanted to be. But he just was a really cool guy. And when you guys read this book, she has other stories about him, and he is an amazingly sweet guy. And those women, I mean, talking about you in front of you to him, and I just thought, props to him. What a knight in shining armor he was, and I loved him.
Yes, he was. But, you know, these were some of the things that you had to get used to as a National Enquirer reporter. People would sometimes feel very free to insult you, and when they didn't know you at all, and you had no bad intentions. You were just there to do your job, you know? But anyway, that was part of the challenge of it. A lot of times, one of the favorite things the Enquirer would have you do, it was called doorstepping. And they would have you go up and knock on a celebrity's front door as if the celebrity would open and say, oh, come on in. Oh, you're National Enquirer here. Come on in.
I just made some cookies. And if you don't like cookies, I've got some great wine for you. Come on in. Well,
that was one of the things that was rather, but I did that a few times. You know, I would try to decline that approach if I possibly could, but sometimes the editor would just insist you do it.
Well, tell us about your Robert Culp adventure. This was hysterical.
Actually, that was one of them. That was one of the doorstepping things. I had Bob Culp's home address, and so my editor knew that I had a lot of home addresses.
Mm-hmm.
Days at Rona, so he said to me, oh, I want you to go up there and see if you can, I forget what the story was. So Robert Culp was, he was Bill Cosby's partner on that very early show called I Spy. But he did a lot of other work, too. You know, he did a lot of character work in his later years.
He did Bob and Carol, Ted and Alice. That was one of the things.
That's right.
And he also, I'm addicted to 70s TV movies that I can get on YouTube. And he did a couple good ones, A Cold Night's Death and Outrage, which I worried for you. After I saw that movie, I'm like, uh-oh.
You know, I sort of came a little close there. So I knock on the door, and of course, he turns out he wasn't there, and I did believe at that time. The maid said, well, he'll be back in about 10 minutes. And she was just innocent. She just didn't realize who I was. And I, you know, she didn't really speak the greatest English, and so she didn't understand that I was a reporter. So she invited me to come and sit in the kitchen on this bench and wait for the boss to come home. So I sat there, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, should I really do this or not? This might not be a good idea. Maybe I should leave. And so one side of me said, maybe I should leave. The other side of me said, my God, I'm in his house. I'm right here. He's going to be home. I got to get this story. I got to score. You know. So I waited. And sure enough, Bob Culp came home. And the maid brought him in there, and he said, well, who are you? What are you doing here? I said, oh, well, I'm sorry, Mr. Culp, your maid invited me to come in and wait for you. My name is Barbara Sternig. I'm a senior reporter with the National Enquirer. And it was kind of an Angie Dickinson moment, you know? And he sort of started, his hands went straight down by his sides. And I thought, oh, my God, I hope he's not going to pull a gun on me, you know? And he said, you know, Ms. Sternig, he said, I appreciate your interest. He said, but let me make a suggestion to you. I think the best idea is going to be for you to leave my home right now. And his voice started to rise up, and I'm backing up as fast as I can towards the door. And I'm out the door and getting down the street as fast as I can to get in my car.
Did he swear at you or anything? Because I know he said something in the book. He said, like, you better leave because I don't know what I would do if you do not leave now. And to me, if you saw Outrage, you know, I think you'd have gotten another slug, frankly.
Well, maybe. Oh, my God, that would have been a worse one.
I know.
It was a real, what you would call a suppressed rage. So, and you know, I want everybody, if they read Secrets of a Tabloid Reporter, read the Bob Culp chapter, and then you will find out a sort of a follow-up to that experience that happened a couple of years later, me and Bob Culp. And I'm not going to say anything about it. Kind of an amazing epilogue to that incident.
Which was funny. I laughed. Okay, here's one we have to talk about. I used to laugh at country music singers when I was a kid because they used to wear those stupid bouffant hairdos and wear those poofy sleeve shirts and things like that. And there was Tammy Wynette. You had to get a story about Tammy Wynette. And boy, did you get a story. So tell us about Tammy Wynette.
Yes. She was a dear lady. This was one of those things that you had to use all of your instincts and all of your little sideways thinking to figure out how to do this. But she was staying at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel. And I was supposed to go and find her and try to interview her. So I went over to the Wilshire Hotel, and I thought, how can I really do this? I called the hotel from a payphone inside the hotel, and I asked for Tammy's room. And I said, that's right. The story was about a romance with Burt Reynolds that she was having. So I said it was from Burt Reynolds' office and that I had something to deliver to Miss Wynette. And so I said, Burt wants me to take it right to the room personally. Can you tell me the room number? And they told me the room number, okay? So now I had her room number. Now I have to get something to deliver to her. So I went by some sort of a function that was being held. It was just breaking up, and they always have flowers on the table, you know? So I grabbed one of the centerpieces, and now I go up to the room. I knock on Tammy's door, and I said, I'm so-and-so. I'm from Burt Reynolds' office. Burt wants you to have these. And I shoved the flowers at her, never thinking that I could get anything more out of it, but just the fact that she accepted them, that was a confirmation for me. Then she said, why don't you come in? You're from Burt's? How's Burt doing? Well, anyway, you have to read the whole thing, but she invited me into her room, and I began to feel worse and worse because she just poured out her heart to me. You know?
Yeah, and she was wearing her nightie. It was a girl's night. She was wearing a nightie and pink sponge. Remember those curlers?
Yes, exactly. And couldn't have been more down to earth. I just loved her. I wanted to give her a hug, and here I was. That was one of those times that I just felt so lousy about myself because I had deceived this very nice woman, you know.
Who totally trusted you, 100%.
Yes, and I didn't, and I did not mean to have it go so far. I just wanted to get the confirmation if she accepted those flowers as Burt's, you know, kind of gift.
Because both of them were kind of denying that they were any kind of an item.
Yes, that's right. They both were, and that was the proof that that was not true. But anyway, she took it over the top, and I just still want to apologize. Please forgive me.
In heaven, she's dead.
I know she's up there in heaven, and I hope she has forgiven
me. I'm sure she would, because she did, she was adorable, and it seemed that she was insecure about Burt, so she was kind of pumping you for info about Burt. And then she was going to be on the Dinah Shore show the next morning.
Yeah.
Wasn't she?
Yeah,
and Dinah had a fling, a couple-year thing with Burt, but Dinah broke up with him because she didn't want to be the old lady with the young man, and she figured he'd dump her soon. And Tammy, I don't know who went out with Burt, but had gone on Dinah's show, and Dinah was a little bit of a tigress with her. I don't remember who it was, but she was afraid that Dinah was going to be mean to her.
That's all in the book. Yes, that's right. I forgot all about that. Well, I haven't read my book for a while, but you have.
Yeah, it's great. But it was just the whole thing and how vulnerable Tammy was. You just got her vulnerability big time. You're sitting on the other twin bed. She's spilling her heart out to you. And it just made me sad. And I wonder if Dinah was mean to her, number one, and what she did when she found out that you were not really Burt's assistant.
Oh, God, I was hoping that she probably had to find out. She would never know who exactly I was, but she would have found out.
And it was in the Inquirer.
It was. That's true. Well, then she probably got my name only when the story came out.
Mm.
But anyway, she never did one mean thing to me in retribution, not one thing.
Well, I think, you know, she was a lovely woman. She had a lot of heartache. She was raising five girls. And at that time, how old do you think she was at that time? 35 or something? 36?
At that time, let me think. Maybe 40. Yeah, she could have been 40. She died very young. I think she was only 52 or 3, or maybe in her early 50s. Yeah, she was probably maybe about 40 at that time.
Poor lady. Yeah, but you know what? It just shows her how sweet, you know, what a kind woman she was, how sweet and vulnerable she was. She got married tons of times, and that she was the stand-by-your-man, guys. If you ever go to places and little bars, they always have Tammy on there, no matter what. No matter what generation, Tammy's on there. And somebody plays it, people sing that song, Stand By Your Man anthem. Yeah, she was great. And what a story. And I just fell in love with Tammy. I want you to tell us. Huh?
Yeah, I hope I could portray these people as they really were.
Oh, you did. Tammy came off as the sweetest, loveliest, so insecure. She was trying to get questions out of you, and you're saying, well, Bert really does care about you. You were being very kind and giving her nice feedback about Bert, even though you had no clue, but I think he really did like her. But
I can't imagine anybody not liking her.
Yes, she sounds like the sweetest thing. I wanted to marry her after this. Come on. I'm straight. So I don't know. I mean, sitting around with her pink hair, pink curlers, life would have been fun. Okay. I want you to tell us about that bad boy who ended up making Hotel Hell, Rory Calhoun, Hound Dog, USA.
Oh, I know. Oh, Rory Calhoun was a handsome old-timey guy.
God, was he cute.
Oh, he was very, very handsome.
He had all his hair.
Yeah, he had, he had a mustache. He was very tall and handsome. He was a cowboy star and kind of a romantic star. I think he was in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
Was Rory?
Is that the one that had the park ranger in it? Or How to Marry a Millionaire?
Oh, yes, he was in How to Marry a Millionaire. He ended up being Betty Grable Squeeze. Hubba Hubba. Right. Very cute.
Hubba Hubba. But he was a handsome man of that old era, and he was quite an older gent by the time I started to work in Hollywood, but still extremely handsome. And I met him at some function, a Hollywood function, a big Hollywood function, and he asked me for my phone number, which I gave him. I gave him my work number, though I didn't give him my home number, because I was brand new in Hollywood, and I didn't know what the deal was. I didn't know the score and everything. So anyhow, sure enough, he called me, and he took me out, and we had a, first of all, he was quite nice on the telephone and very complimentary. And then he took me out to an outing out in Apple Valley. We went out to Roy Rogers and Dale Evans Ranch for the afternoon. Right?
Oh, my.
So I was quite impressed with that. That was really neat. But I thought he was quite nice. He was very gentlemanly during the day, and we had a wonderful time. Then he brings me back to my apartment, and that's where the big grab started.
The octopus.
Oh, my God. I didn't know how I was going to escape from this, and he was even pushing the door and everything, and I thought, how I ever got in that front door. This was a brush, and then I thought, my God, is this what girls have to go through here in Hollywood? Well, you know what? I think we have learned lately that is what a lot of girls have to go through.
Yes.
It is. But, you'll read another one of these epilogues about Rory Calhoun if you read the second book. The one that's Celebrity Secrets of a National Crime Reporter. And that's a part of, believe it or not, part of the Robert Mitchum chapter. And I met up with Rory Calhoun again, and you'll see what happened then.
It is something else. And all I can say is, he did all that pork stuff in Hotel Hell. And I can say about Rory, oink, oink. He was a little piggy, but
He was a ladies' man.
He was, and he was cute to the day. You know, I've watched that horrible Motel Hell, and he still looked like a hunk of burning love.
Yeah, he was a hunk of burning love. You know, and just the typical movie. Talk about tall, dark, and handsome. That was Rory Calhoun.
Hubba. Okay, I think we should end it on this story, which is a riot. Maybe people don't know, but in the 80s, Wheel of Fortune was humongous. Pat Sajak and Vanna White were huge, huge stars. It was like Wheel of Fortune, then Jeopardy. I know Cary Grant and his wife used to eat their milk and turkey sandwiches watching Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy. I mean, it was a thing. They were like, what will Vanna wear today? So, right, Barbara, they were humongous stars.
Yeah, and I think the shows are still huge. I don't know that I think Alex Trebek will always be a huge star from Jeopardy. Pat and Vanna, they endure, you know, people love them still. But yes, you're right, back in the 80s or early 90s, they were just all over the tabloids all the time. And so I was given the assignment to cover Pat Sajak's wedding. And I know we have to wrap this up quickly, so I'll just get down to the bare bones of it. It was being held it was where the Naval Academy is, you know.
Annapolis?
Annapolis, Maryland. So that was where the wife's family lived there, and the bride-to-be's family lived there. So I went over there, and I had a small team with me, and I was just racking my brain. I found out where the church was going to be, where the wedding would be, and I just happened to walk in when the wedding planner was there, and I just sort of sidled up to her meeting with some of the wedding participants. I just sort of had my ear to the side so I could hear what the details were and what the time frame and everything was going to be. It was going to be at 7 o'clock in the evening. Well, that church had a 5:30 Mass, and so I thought, oh, heck, I can legitimately go to Mass at 5:30. I'm Catholic, so I did. I went to the 5:30 Mass, and during the Mass, when the Mass was getting to the end, I just kind of sort of sneaked and slithered into one of the confessionals. I can stay here during the wedding. Nobody won't. There's not going to be any confession. They won't even know I'm here. I'll be able to see this whole wedding. It had a curtain. So I took my ballpoint pen and I poked holes in the curtain so I could see all that.
You bad girl.
Bad girl. And so it was quite appropriate that I was in a confessional since I was committing this horrible sin while I was in there. But anyway, I stayed in the confessional. After the Mass was ended, the church went all dark, and I thought, oh, did I get this wrong? All the lights are off. It's perfectly silent. What if they lock the church? What if I get locked in here overnight? Then what am I going to do? Well, anyway, sure enough, about 6:45, the lights snap on. The organist starts practicing. All the church ladies come in. They roll down the white carpet. They put the flowers on the altar. They put this and that and everything. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, this is such a bingo. This is a get. I am going to be observing this whole wedding. So then just when the wedding was about to start, the church ladies are finishing up, and they say, oh, my God, you know what? Maybe we should just check the confessionals. You know, he's got that Maryland National Guard out front just to keep the National Enquirer out of here. Wouldn't it be funny? National Enquirer people do anything. Ha, 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 ha. And I'm going, oh, my God, no, no, no. Well, anyway, they went around to each and every confessional, and mine was the very last one. And there I was. Well, you have to read the book to find out what happened next, but... Anyway,
it was so funny. It was so funny. And not only do you do that, you also sneak into the wedding, and it's a pouring, rainy night. She has had so many incredible experiences, you guys. They are so funny. We've left out tons. She was on the same plane, first class, with Princess Caroline and the playboy, Philippe Junot. You can find out what happened on that. She has more on Princess Diana, Frank Sinatra, two stories, so much stuff. And like I said, I laughed. I went, oh, my God. I did so much. much as I was reading your book, but more than anything, I enjoyed them. And, you know, I loved Scoops. And, you know, I don't know. It's just such a good book. And you can find out more about Rory Calhoun, oink, oink. And Robert Mitchum was also in another story. So much stuff. You guys will love them.
And we should mention that the books are both available at my website. Very easy. It's just www.barbarasternig.com. My name, Sternig. And you can even read excerpts from some of the chapters just to whet your appetite a little bit.
It's such a good book. These are good books. So she has two, Secrets of a Tabloid Reporter, My 20 Years on the National Enquirer's Hollywood Beat. There's Angie, Celebrity Secrets of a National Enquirer Reporter, Further Adventures on the Hollywood Beat. And this has been a really, thank you so much for coming on, Barbara.
It's been a pleasure.
And I will also link you up when I post the podcast to your webpage. And you guys, these are great reads, easy reads. And if you like Scoops, this is just the book for you. And I love Scoops. We didn't tell you everything because we didn't have time. And, you know, we want you to read the books. A lot of good stuff. So thank you so much, Barbara. You've been fantastic. And
thank you, Grace.
If you ever want to come on again, please do, because I'm sure you didn't write everything down in these books, and we can talk about the documentary or anything. So,
that would be a pleasure. Yes,
you are always welcome back. And thanks so much to you, Barbara. And thank you guys for listening to True Stories from Tinseltown. And we will have another one coming up next week. And I will post Barbara's in a couple days. So thank you. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Barbara.
Thank you, Grace.
You are so welcome. Bye, everybody.
The club with its pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is me. The lights on the lady in tights, or the bride with the guy on the side, or the ball where she gives him her all. That's entertainment. The plot can be hot, simply teeming with sex. A gay divorcee who is after her ex. It can be Oedipus Rex, where a chap kills his father and costs a lot of bother. The clerk who is thrown out of work by the boss, who is thrown for a loss by the skirt, who is doing him dirt. The world is the stage. The stage is a world of entertainment.
Scream, a swain getting slain for the love of a queen. Some great Shakespearean scene where a ghost and a prince meet and everyone ends in mincemeat. The gag may be waving the flag that began with the Mr. Cohan. Hip hooray, the American way. The world is a stage. The stage is a world of entertainment.